Tonight on Arena, Charlie McGettigan on reforming jargon and only murders in the building, chaos and Lord of the Rings are our TV shows for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch us live on rte.ie/arena. So we'll begin tonight because it's Wednesday with our TV reviews. First tonight, we look at the brand new dark comedy on Netflix. Chaos is a modern twist on Greek mythology, and the series explores power, gender, politics and the underworld. The Greek gods of Dionysus, Hera and Medusa are all there. And there's the politics of the underworld. There's also the king of the gods, Zeus, and our own Killian Scott is Orpheus, who follows Aurora Perio, who's Eurydice, down into the underworld. Next Prime Video brings us Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. This is a big-budget fantasy spectacular adapted from the backstories found in the notes of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy. It's set in the Second Age of Middle-earth, thousands of years before Frodo walked the earth. And lastly, Only Murders in the Building returns for a fourth season on Disney. Steve Martin, Martin Short and Selena Gomez are back in the roles of Charles, Oliver and Mabel and they have yet another murder to solve on their true crime podcast in their upmarket apartment block, The Arconia. I'm joined in studio now by Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, who have been watching all three. And let's start with the brand new series on Netflix this week, Chaos. It stars Jeff Goldblum and Killian Scott. Now, this is to be released tomorrow, so we're just looking at the premise rather than reviewing the show. So we'll have no stars for Chaos. Chris, we have a family of Greek gods here. Goldblum's tracksuit-wearing Zeus. We've Hera and we've Dionysus. Tell us, who are they in the modern context?
Yeah, we have Zeus, the king of the gods, in tennis shorts, played by Jeff Goldblum. So that is everything you expect it to be. And this series kind of asks the question, what if, you know, if we take classical mythology and we combine it with, you know, contemporary melodrama, what if gods were real in today's world? And what if they had power over the people of Earth? And what if they were just as messed up as, you know, the Roys from Succession? There's an awful lot of articles going around at the moment calling Chaos Succession with gods. And that's sort of the angle they're going with. And in this series, we have Jeff Goldblum playing Zeus, the king of the gods, you know, master of the skies. You know, he's a bit of a he's vain, he's self-absorbed, he's a complete sociopath, and he's obsessed with holding on to his power. And when we first meet him, he is so narcissistic that in the first scene he's literally staring at himself in the mirror. And the reason he's doing that is because he notices a new wrinkle on his forehead, and he is obsessed with this prophecy that says that a lion will appear one day, and that will be the beginning of the end for Zeus. That will be the beginning of the end of, you know, his world and how he's ruled it. And he thinks this is the lion, this prophecy is going to happen, chaos is going to reign. So he just annoys everyone around him, whether it's his sister slash wife Hera, played by the great Janet McTeer, whether it's Prometheus, his old pal, and now his prisoner, because, you know, the story of Prometheus was that, you know, he ended up on the side of Mount Olympus, his liver being pecked out by crows. He is just obsessed with this prophecy, and everyone is telling him it's not going to happen, your reign will continue. But what he doesn't know is that it will happen, and that it's already in motion concerning some of the humans down on Earth.
So is this for somebody who loves Greek mythology, Jen, or can you enjoy it, you know, just as an ordinary punter?
I think, you know, there is a lot going on, and it wants to give you this thrill ride. It wants to give you this thrill ride through Greek mythology. And it is saying, you know, we're not like your fuddy-duddy, fusty historical dramas. We're irreverent. We're very fresh and new. And obviously it is like from the writer that gave us Channel 4's The End of the Effing World, Charlie Coville. So you know that he wants to strike out and make it very much his own and put his own imprint on it. So I think if you do have the basics, as Chris was going through there, of Greek mythology, that will, like, hold, you know, you in good stead. But at the same time, it is one of those things that they just want to bring you into this world, into this very highly stylized world. It kind of looks like a bit of like a Guy Ritchie film, I would say, because there's a lot of that camera work, and then there's a lot of, It kind of almost looks like a David LaChapelle photography. There's that, it's really pin sharp. It's a lot of gaudiness and excess going on and diverting camera work. It gives us this very hyperactive edge. It really is magical realism or Greek mythology for the TikTok generation. They do not want you to take your eyes off the screen for a minute. So I don't really think you need that background, because I think in today's, you know, culture, with the amount of fantasy and kind of those mythical shows that are happening, you know, something like The Boys, even it's indebted to Amazon Prime's The Boys, because it still has that kind of almost, you know, the whole plot is about the 1%. They are gods now in this. They're literal gods. In The Boys, it's superheroes. And it's like, why do we trust these people? Why do we make quote unquote gods of them? Why do we hold them in such high esteem? They're just humans, or they're close enough to, they're fallible at the end of the day. So I think if anybody's watched any of those shows, they will be able to hook into this straight away.
Well, there is the lovely Greek story of Orpheus, who goes into the underworld to find his beautiful bride to be Eurydice, who, you know, who dies. So in this, we meet them before anything tragic happens to her. And it's Irish actor Killian Scott plays Orpheus, and he's a rock star, and he's just played his new song for his girlfriend, who may be having little second ideas about her relationship with Orpheus. This is Eurydice, and she's played by Aurora Perrineau.
What song were you playing just now?
Why did you like it?
Because
I think it sent Dennis to sleep.
Dennis, where is Dennis?
I'm gonna open with it at the palace. If they clear their shit off the monument in time.
What?
Did you not see the news? The monument at the palace.
That's right. No, I did. I saw it.
You're saying it was the Trojans.
Good for them.
Yeah. Anyway, I missed you like crazy this morning. I don't like it when you're not here.
What's it called? The song?
What's up, buddy?
The song, Orpheus?
Eurydice. What?
My name. I did the poster.
I thought you liked the poster. Oh, shit, you don't like it.
No, it's just that.
What?
I don't know. Can't you just love me quietly?
Well, no.
So Eurydice, as Killian Scott pronounces that, and it's Aurora Perrineau. It plays Eurydice, and Killian Scott plays Orpheus. Can you tell us, or would that be giving away too much, how they do the underworld? Or is interesting?
I think we can talk a little bit about it, because I'm sure listeners are probably listening to everything that we just said about the plot involving Zeus. And then when you hear that clip, you think, well, that sounds like just a contemporary drama about a rock star and his wife on the verge of a breakup. But it is quite clever how, you know, I don't think it's a spoiler to say that, you know, she will end up in the underworld, and he will end up, you know, befriending somebody who is involved, you know, is either maybe a family member of Zeus, to try and go into the underworld and get her back. And how that's actually brought to the screen is quite clever. The underworld is depicted as this icy monochrome landscape where everyone arrives in these, you know, cruise ships, and they're told that if they were buried right and if they led a good life, then they've nothing to worry about. And we've got David Toulis as well playing Hades, and he's in these really awful introduction to the afterlife videos. All that stuff is really clever, and that's how we get from what sounds like a very grounded realistic drama, again about a breakup, to something connected with Zeus's downfall.
It did look a little bit like Dunkirk, though. I did think there was a bit of it there. I was like, they're robbing a little bit off Dunkirk, and They have all these set pieces in it that they want, you know, to really.
And that's done in black
focus.
And white,
yeah,
it's as done well.
In black and white as well. So anybody that has seen like that scene in Dunkirk where they're all on the pier, it kind of is very reminiscent of that. And then those videos with David Toulis kind of reminded me a little bit of Vanilla Sky as well. It has that injection of, like, you know, the afterlife kind of videos in Vanilla Sky as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of references in this, and it's crammed full of them, like, and musical references as well. Like, I mean, you're getting needle drops from the minute this show starts, from like Dire Straits, everything from Dire Straits to the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, you know, to Paul Simon. I mean, it's crammed full of, like, a lot of very recognisable pop culture IP that they want, they genuinely want it to reach the biggest audience as possible, I think, because you do have, you know, Jeff Goldblum is surrounded by serious talent, like we're saying, Janet McTeer, David Thewlis, Billy Piper, who's always amazing, I think, in anything she puts her hand to. So it is...
What role does she play?
But she is almost like a prophet.
Kind of a cameo.
Like
a,
and so we haven't... As it gets further into it, I think she's predicting the future for a lot of people and she's really unhappy about it. So she is a quote-unquote J.D. Vance will love her. She is a crazy cat lady and she's there kind of on the edge because she doesn't enjoy her job where she sees too much almost. And it really kind of, with those actors in it, kind of does ground it in that thespian world, you know, it gives it a more, because it is outrageous and satirical, it kind of gives it a more a good stand in them because you have these big names in
it, I suppose. Well, you sound like you're going to keep watching it, Jen.
I think there's, you know, it's a lot of crash bang in it. It's a lot of style going on and I think it needs to settle down a bit. It feels very frantic, I think, at the beginning and that it all depends on how you feel about how frantic it is at the beginning, whether you will stick with it or not. But I will say, you know, someone like Navan Rizwan, who's playing Dionysus, and I think anybody that's seen the first season of Industry will know he's one to watch, like, and his brother is the comedian Marwan Rizwan. So I think they're a very talented family, but I don't know. I'd have to see. I want to see more in one way, but I don't know.
And what about Killian Scott?
Well, Killian Scott, I mean, he's an awful lot to do here because, I mean, he has to play a human who is obviously aware that the gods are ruling the world and that they're real, but also be surprised when he embarks on this big adventure, which we probably can't talk about. Mm-hmm. I think there's an awful lot of conflicting tones in here. Sometimes it feels as though there's 2, 3, even 4 shows competing for our attention, and there's an awful lot of explaining to do. I mean, Prometheus literally narrates the show from the side of that cliff, so you do have to, it's like you need to be taking notes sometimes, you know, the little Greek mythology guidebook by your side wouldn't go amiss. So it's a lot, I would say, but
well,
you know,
if they think that's complicated, wait till we get to Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, that's true.
But thank you for that. We won't take stars, we'll just go on to Only Murders in the Building. It's back for its 4th season on Disney Plus and has the same star-studded cast of pop star and actress Selena Gomez and the comedy duo Steve Martin and Martin Short. The podcast team have another grisly murder to solve and LA is calling as there's an opportunity to make a movie on their true crime podcast. Before they go, let's hear Charles, played by Steve Martin, speak the epilogue to their true crime podcast, their previous one, with Mabel, Selena Gomez, recording.
Only hours ago, we solved this murder and closed the curtain on not one, but 2 criminal Broadway producers. So with that, friends in podcast land, we conclude yet another season of Only Murders in the Building. Until next time, I'm Charles Hay.
What the hell?
Jesus.
Power surge. That hasn't happened in a while.
Not since they banned the old incinerator.
Should I redo that last speech, maybe just the end?
And we're back up?
I need to, you know.
And action.
Ben Savage. You can just splice that onto the Charles Hay.
Yeah, I'll get out the splicer.
What a night, huh?
Hey, why don't we head up to my place for a proper nightcap? Maybe a little quick toast to the miracles we pulled off together.
I do like a sentimental moment, especially if the liquor is good.
Ha!
I don't, but I like liquor.
And away we go.
I must say, Jen, after I saw Chaos and then went into Only Murders in the Building, it came as a relief. Everybody was in their proper place and there was not a huge cast.
Yes, exactly. And I think, you know, that's the thing about Only Murders. Like when it burst onto our screens back in 2021, we were all in a very different place. We're, you know, lockdown centric and we're looking for something to ease your kind of frazzled mind. And it was such a great cozy distraction. And like even from the very opening credits where it looks like the front cover of a New Yorker magazine, you know, with the typeface and the drawings of the, you know, the apartment block and the crime kind of light storylines, nothing too heavy, like nothing too intense or bloody or violent, like, and let alone the fact that the two main leads, like Steve Martin and Martin Short, you know, most of the audience, its audience have grown up with them, or at least have one of their films as a comfort watch, like Father of the Bride or The Three Amigos or something. So I really always felt like I had this great familiarity to it and this great ease to it. And we all just enjoyed it so much. Well, I'm speaking for myself, but like after three seasons, and it kind of, as it's gone on, has gone a little bit more starry at every turn. And last season, you know, we had the introduction of Meryl Streep's character and as Loretta Durkin, and she was, you know, there to be Oliver's paramour, and Oliver was going back to Broadway, his first love, so he was back on stage again. So it kind of moved it a bit away from just the environs of the Arconia, kind of more into New York, and now we're going even further in season four.
I just don't know why series do that. Like Downton Abbey do it, and all these series that are, they're absolutely fine with new actors that we're discovering, and then, you know, they start throwing these old stars.
It's like
at
when
it.
EastEnders, when you take the characters from EastEnders out of Albert Square or something, it just doesn't work. It feels like you're looking at a giraffe in the middle of a motorway or something. It just doesn't make sense. It's a weird juxtaposition. And it really feels like that at first glance in season four. It does feel like that because they're moving them to LA. They're going to LA to meet these people, these execs that want to make a film of the podcast. But not only that, they're meeting the stars of the film. So you're getting into the world where it's very self-referential. So we're in a world where Steve Martin doesn't exist because he's playing Charles, and Martin Short doesn't exist because he's playing Oliver. But then somebody like, you know, the star, Eva Longoria is, you know, Eva Longoria in it though, because she's going to be playing Mabel. So it's a very strange feeling because your suspension of disbelief is messed with then, I think, when you start doing this thing where Zach Galifianakis appears and starts talking about Between Two Ferns, his spoof TV show, his spoof talk show. You're like, what world are we living in then? I'm very confused. And that kind of irritated
me. I did like this, Chris, the Selena Gomez thing and the Eva Longoria, because the Mabel character is showing a kind of vulnerability.
Yeah.
She doesn't like the way she's written in the script. And I don't know if Eva Longoria is being honest with her or is actually just trying for her to sign up to it. But it's also a good dynamic.
They're also poking fun at the idea that because they've aged Mabel up for the fictional film within the series, because, you know, studio executives got together and they said it's a little bit creepy. You know, test audiences thought it was a little bit creepy, these two older guys being friends with a 20-something.
And that is a good joke.
It is, yeah. But thankfully, that the whole LA business, it actually, that comes to an end after the first episode, and then we're back to New York, and I was delighted to see that, because season three I had the same problems as Jen. I also had a problem where they split the gang up and there wasn't much, there was crime solving, but there wasn't much podcasting. We didn't get the same kind of chemistry between them because they were all kind of going their separate ways, and Charles, the unemployed, you know, half retired actor, he actually got a gig. Oliver was directing on Broadway and he was in love with Meryl Streep's character. This time it's as though they looked at the reviews for season three and said, yeah, let's make it a about the investigating. And they do have an investigation on their hands, because at the end of season three, Saz Pataki, played by Jane Lynch, who is Charles's stunt double and also his best pal, she was heading up to his apartment to grab a bottle of wine to have that nightcap with them that we just heard in that clip, and she was shot. And so obviously, because she was in Charles's apartment, the bullet was meant for Charles. So it all becomes an investigation about her murder, and that's how we get back to the only murders in the building stuff.
And it works. Is the murder ever interesting?
Yes.
Yeah. I think this time around it definitely is. But I do also like the fact that they are drawing attention to something like with the true crime genre, how, you know, the people that are presenting or involved in true crime, they become the stars, and then the people that actually the victims of the crime, their lives become smaller and smaller. So you see that when they're trying to sign over the life rights to the film execs, because it's like, well, they're playing with archetypes of the podcasters, just like the podcasters play with the archetypes of the victim. So I think that kind of is clever. There's always a cleverness to it, but I do think, yes, the murder side to it is very interesting, because it's Saz, and we're, you know, the Jane Lynch character is so good, and it is so well done. And I think, I mean, it's hard to fault it. I mean, it's hard to fault it. I mean,
stars out of five from you, Chris.
I think it works as both, you know, this like sarky spoof of the murder mystery genre, but it also works as a murder mystery genre in itself, because I'm sitting there even after like five or six episodes going, I don't know who did it, and I don't know where this is going. You're constantly having the rope pulled from under you. That those three actors, Gomez, Short, and obviously Steve Martin, you know, they're best pals. They are wonderful together. So even if it is a bit too gimmicky at times, even if it's not as magical as the first two seasons. You know, good Only Murders is better than no Only Murders. So it's 4 stars.
Yeah. 4 stars. And from you, Jen?
I'd watch Martin Short do anything. As I said, I'd just watch him lie on the floor and do a bicycle in the air. He's the best. And like, we've grown to love them as three.
I'm sure they're taking notes.
And we love them together. I mean, but I do worry that they need to keep a tight rein on what make the show so lovable in the first place. And I think the further we move away from the Arconia, the less interesting it gets. And I don't want it to become that. So, but I would say 4 out of 5. Oh,
great. Okay. So we're coming back after the break to Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power.
RTE, the home of great local drama. A devastating earthquake. A family torn apart.
Our units have completed their search.
And a mystery to unravel.
I saw him here in Dublin.
What are you doing, Harry?
Fighting the truth.
Based on the best-selling novel by Karen Perry.
I never felt that he was gone. You know why?
Why?
Because he's my son.
The Boy That Never Was. Starts Sunday at 9:30 on RTE One and RTE Player.
Ma'am, when we got the new car, did we ever give you a spare key? Can you check? We've locked Max in the car with ours. He might be advanced for his age, but he's definitely not unlocked the car by himself advanced.
It happens. It's better to have roadside rescue as standard. Get 10% off car insurance when you buy online at aig.ie. It's got to be AIG. Normal underwriting acceptance criteria apply. Subject to terms and conditions. Applies to new AIG direct customers only. Minimum premium applies. AIG Europe SA is authorised by the Luxembourg Ministry of Finance and supervised by the Luxembourg Commissioner for Insurance and is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland for conduct of business rules.
This summer, see the European box office smash that critics are raving about. The Count of Monte Cristo is timeless and thrillingly new. 5 stars, says Total Film. Rotten Tomatoes rates it at 100%. It's a big, exciting, swashbuckling adventure. Stunning, a genuine triumph. Based on Alexandre Dumas' classic tale.
Je suis le Comte de Monte Cristo.
The Count of Monte Cristo. In cinemas Friday. Certificate 12A.
Hi, Eileen Dunn here, urging you to take part in Bewley's big coffee morning for hospice by hosting a coffee morning for your local hospice on Thursday the 26th of September or a date that suits. To register for your free pack, call 0818 995 996 or visit hospicecoffeemorning.ie.
RTE Radio 1.
Irish National Opera, in association with Bord Gáis Energy Theatre, presents Verdi's Rigoletto. In a special co-production with the acclaimed Santa Fe Opera, experience this thrilling tale of love, intrigue and revenge. Playing for 4 performances only from December 1st to 7th. Featuring the Irish National Opera Orchestra. Tickets available now. Bord Gáis Energy Theatre.ie. Funded by the Arts Council.
Entertainment updates on RTE Radio 1.
Well, it's TV review night here, and Arena and Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have already told us about Chaos and Only Murders in the Building Season 4. And now Prime Video brings us a spin-off from Tolkien's Lord of the Ring trilogy. It's 20 years since Peter Jackson first brought them to the big screen, and this TV series brings us back thousands of years before The Hobbit. The series is credited with being the most expensive TV show Prime Video have ever made, so it's a lot to live up to. Now, it is complicated. Mm. They're complicated plots. So, Chris, maybe you just tell us where we are in the Rings of Power.
Yeah.
Bring us into it, gently.
It's a simple question, but there are no simple answers. This is set a couple of millennia before The Hobbit and before the Lord of the Rings stories that we would have seen in the Peter Jackson stories. And it's a time of peace. And in the first season, it's the second age of Middle Earth. And in the first season, we saw that this elven warrior played by Morfydd Clark, her name is Galadriel, she was trying to warn her superiors and just everyone in the kingdoms around her that, you know, this great evil Sauron was, you know, back. You know, everyone just thought that he had disappeared and that a time of war was coming, but nobody wanted to hear any of us. And she had actually encountered Sauron, who was hiding in plain sight. She had acquired this ally on her travels, this shipwrecked ally, and she didn't realise that this guy played by Charlie Vickers was actually Sauron. So at the end of the... And also in the first season, we had this enormous... bearded stranger who is come to be known as the Stranger, played by David Wayman. literally falling from the sky like this human star who befriends all of the hobbits. We're calling them Harfoots in this series, but I'm going to stick with hobbits. He befriends these people, and they set off on a quest with him at the end of season one to find out who he is and what his magic is about and if he can control it. So season two basically picks up on the story with Morphy Clark's character, where, you know, Sauron is very much real, and despite the fact that he was cast out of the Elven Kingdom, you know, he's clearly somewhere else in the world, and they need to find them before he kind of, you know,
because he's coming to get them.
He really is. Yeah. He'll lead an army of orcs, and they will, you know, that will end up nowhere fun, basically. And also we have the stranger trying to figure out who he is, and just everyone on edge, because you also have the elves basically developing, forging the rings of power, and in the wrong hands, as we saw in the films, these rings can lead to destruction.
Okay, I think that's very good. Yeah.
And you don't need to watch it.
Yeah, you're so relieved as well that you didn't have to do it.
That
Jen.
Was like doing maths. Don't ask me to do this.
So, Jen, is this for people who love the films and love the series? Obviously,
the thing is, I loved the films, and I'm not like a fantasy, you know, type gal. I'm not. That's not my thing. But like, I really enjoyed those films. I think Peter Jackson did something amazing with them, because he made them so accessible for people that don't want to read the books, and they made it so inviting and, you know, intriguing. And there's a reason why people go back to those films again and again and again. And there's a reason why cinemas can hold weekends showing them, because they are pure entertainment. But with the first season, it was not entertaining. For me, it was so boring that I couldn't believe that so much money was spent on it, because you couldn't see it on the screen. Yet again, it falls for that new fantasy trope of, you know, being buried in browns and blues and like that. We can only blame Game of Thrones for that, really, because they gave that template to the world, I suppose.
You mean it's so murky you can't actually see it?
Yeah, and then the plot line, I mean, we're talking Attack of the Clone kind of boredom in the plot line in the first season, because it was all, you know, putting the mechanics together of trying to explain the story and trying to explain who everybody was. And it was a lot of talking and no action and no set pieces in that way. And I felt it was really drawn out. And then you had the problem with the Harfoots, where it's like the stage Irishness to them that was just so off-putting. I couldn't go any further with it. I found it very turgid and hard to penetrate. Now, this time around, they're trying to give, I think, the fans what they want, which is those epic kind of battle sequences. It is the violence, and it's a lot heavier this time around. I think they've learned, like, too much exposition and not enough darkness is not what this show should be about. So I think they're trying to get that balance better. And you've got your creepy monsters, you've got your magical spells, and also, most importantly, with the Sauron reveal, you have that rise and feeling of inescapable dread. And that's, I think, is a key to any fantasy like series, where you want that big bad to feel like it's always there, coming up behind you and coming up behind the goodies. And I think that gets it right this time around, thankfully.
You agree?
I think parts of it are a lot more compelling than last time. There is a bit more action. I thought there was a prologue in the first episode that explains, you know, what Sauron was up to, and we get to see him portrayed by a different actor briefly, Jack Loudon.
What was that about? I said I know that actor, and then suddenly he's gone.
Yeah, it was a fun cameo for Jack Loudon. I'd say maybe a day on set before he's, you know, killed by orcs. And again, that's not a spoiler. That is basically the origin.
But why did he have to be different than when they hatch him out again?
I think maybe this character always takes a different human form to trick those around him to acquire his army. Right. So that's why we see it. I thought that actually, so that section that builds up to when Galadriel found him in the very first episode of season one, that was well done. But no episode of a series like this should pass the 60-minute mark. And unfortunately, you have episodes here passing the 70 or 75-minute mark.
Mm. It needs. And how many episodes in it?
And there's going to be eight episodes. Eight in total. Yeah.
All right, okay.
And you can't shake this feeling either that Peter Jackson had the best material to work with, and Prime Video have the B-sides.
Because these
they
are
have the notes. They just have the liner notes.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
So these are notes that Tolkien had before he wrote Lord of the Rings.
Or leftover.
So like, it's like, imagine having the Ulysses remix. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, is that what you want to play around with? I don't know. So you are right. They are kind of damned if they do, damned if they don't. Yeah. But I do think it is an expensive mistake, I think, for Prime, because you're wondering, is this just a rich man's folly? Is it just because they spent so much money they have to keep on going? Mm. Or is it because they have the money they want to make it better and better? I don't know. It's not hitting the mark for me anyway.
Okay, stars out of five for Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power. Pris?
I like this world and I like what they're trying to do. So I'm going to go with three and stick with it for a couple more. But I don't know if that love's going to last.
Okay, Jen?
2.5. A half for the orcs.
Yeah, the orcs are
genuinely
terrifying.
They are genuinely terrifying.
So Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser, thank you so much. Chaos, The Lord of the Rings, Rings of Power is on Prime Video. Only Murders in the Building, season 4 is on Disney. Sorry, Chaos is on Netflix. Developed at Fringe Lab with the support of the Dublin Fringe Festival and Seen and Heard Festival. Bad Girl is a one-man show by writer, stand-up comedian, actor and filmmaker Felix O'Connor. In this comedy, Felix looks back at, according to him, the glaringly obvious signs from his adolescence that he willfully ignored, that he is a trans man, making fun of himself in ways that his school bullies never could. Bad Girl will be running from the 17th to the 21st of September in Bewley's Café Theatre as part of this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. Welcome, Felix.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
So, as I said, Bad Girls is a deeply personal story, but it's full of laughs, full of comedy moments. How difficult was it for you to navigate those teenage years?
Oh, well, I think everyone has a bad time being a teenager. And I think everyone's able to kind of look back with, you know, hindsight being 2020, looking back and being like, I was an idiot. And I didn't know how to talk to people and I didn't. And there were all of these signs that I was missing. And then being trans and being queer, I'm looking back at that and I just have all of this context. And I think that's very easy to mine for comedy. And so that's something that I've tried to do with this show, something that I'm trying to do. I think something really beautiful about comedy is that it really reaches out to people and it brings people in, and it's a great way of making people engaged with storytelling. And I think when it comes to understanding trans issues and understanding trans people, that's such an important part of it, that people can see themselves in these experiences that aren't super universal necessarily. You know what I mean?
So what was that teenager like who was seeing these signs and willfully ignoring them?
I used to be a lot more introverted. Some of that was just kind of not really knowing how to talk to people or relate to people. I've always been obsessed with media and storytelling. I would kind of I would bury my head in books and these kind of fantasy worlds. I think that's quite common with young kind of queer people and young trans people is we'll find a sanctuary in fiction and science fiction and all these kind of fantasy worlds, because the thing that maybe we think we might want or might need, which is transition, it feels like magic, you know? It seems so impossible to actually achieve. And so I think that's why so many of us are kind of creative people. And yeah, so like as a teenager, this show particularly, I'm talking about being 14, which in my opinion is one of the worst ages a person can be.
By 14.
14, I think it's around 14 where the kind of shine of being a teenager has like worn off, has worn away. Because I think we all kind of buy into the like the Disney Channel or the Nickelodeon kind of propaganda that like, yeah, being a teenager is really cool. And then by 14, you're kind of like, wait, is this bad actually? And I've got to do this for how much longer? Oh no, that's a long time.
And tell us then, you were talking about those wonderful popular cultural references that kind of, you know, help you if not steer you in the right in the direction you want to go in. Mm. But at least it's a great salve for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kind of seeing yourself in kind of fictional characters. I mean, I have a whole section of the show where I have a kind of presentation where I talk about characters that I related to as a child. And one of them is like, they're very silly. One of them is like James and the Giant Peach after he's been turned into claymation in the James and the Giant Peach movie. And there's something about just a claymation character where it's like, I'm meant to be a flesh and blood little boy, but I'm claymation and I don't know what to do about it. That kind of feels very it feels akin to my own experience being like, something is off and I don't know what to do about it or how to fix it. I don't know what it is, but I relate to it.
Okay, well, in another we have a clip here from the play.
Yes.
And here the reference is The Princess Bride. And this is
Anne The Princess Diaries, actually, sorry.
Princess Diaries, and it's the Anne Hathaway.
Mm-hmm.
The one film that I think does do it right is The Princess Diaries. Because in that film, you have extended montages of Anne Hathaway learning to look and act like a princess. And all that took was weeks of coaching, thousands of dollars of investments, and the fate of a nation on the line. That's what I needed to commit to femininity. I mean, like, what's the saying? You know, give a man a fish and feed him for a day. Teach a man to serve fish. And, oh, honey, he'll eat.
That's Felix O'Connor there from his one-man show, Bad Girl. So you really get the idea of the show from that, Felix.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of, again, I'm kind of using like media, pop culture references to talk about the kind of the makeover trope in a lot of kind of, especially like girls coming of age films, where you have these kind of awkward, gangly, you know, maybe little antisocial kind of characters who, again, I related to immensely as someone who wasn't very good at talking to people and wasn't very good at making friends. And I think a lot of people do. That's why these films are so successful and important to people. But the issue that I have is like, you've got these kind of makeover sequences and then suddenly they're able to, they're just able to maintain it and they're able to do it forever and it's all fine. One makeover, it's all you need. And just kind of poking fun at the absurdity of that and how it kind of doesn't really work that way.
Now, who is Mildred Mina Mulhall?
Oh, Mildred Mina Mulhall. So it's kind of a mystery from my adolescence that like has gone many years kind of unsolved. This was like a character that some girls in my school like invented, and they would like be kind of creating lore about this character, and essentially they would be kind of making fun of this fictional person. And a realization that I've come to, they'd come into school on Monday and they'd be like, oh, what did Mildred do over the weekend? And they'd be like, oh, Mildred's mom wouldn't let her shave her legs above the knees. And I was like, that's weird, because that's something that I'm insecure about. And I kind of, looking back on it, it was genius because it was a way for these girls to kind of proxy bully several people in the class while not bullying anyone technically. And it was, you know, real Guantanamo yes. Bay psychological warfare stuff, where that's a bit.
And,
yeah.
And did it dawn on you then? Obviously, it made you, what they said about Mildred Mina Mulhall made you uncomfortable, but you didn't know whether it was particularly at you or.
Yeah, it was just there was no way of proving anything. And it was just like everyone was kind of laughing along at this joke. And I was like, I don't get it. And I'm sure I wasn't the only one who was insecure about these things in the class as well, where it's kind of, again, that's part of the genius of it. It was an evil genius idea.
Now, you talked about makeovers there in the mm-hmm. in the Princess Diaries, and there was also a lot of wannabe fairy godmothers, wasn't there?
Yeah.
That wanted to fix you in some way.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of people like a project. And again, you have all these films where, you know, people get kind of taken under someone's wing and their lives are improved by the one makeover they need. And I had a lot of people who were very well-meaning, and I really like tried to kind of perform what they wanted me to be after these kinds of makeovers. And it put us all in kind of an awkward situation because...
Would this involve dress, makeup? Or
Okay. Full like, and I was involved in like musicals and shows and stuff in school, and there would always be like hair and makeup stuff for that, and people would be like, well, why don't you do this every day? And I'm like, makeup is so expensive and I don't know how to do it, like, are you gonna do this for me every day? And then it didn't fit, it wasn't me. But it took a long time to stop trying to make it fit as well. And that's kind of a lot of what the focus of the show is as well, where it's, finding yourself. It's a retrospective on finding yourself and growing up and looking back and being like, this is what I needed, and I wish I had someone like me to look up to at the time.
Now, without giving the show away, there is a very poignant finish to the end to the show.
Yes. So I end the show with, it's a little bit of a lie that it's a one-man show. There is a secret guest at the end of the show. I'm not going to give too much away, but it's there's a secret guest and a big musical number right at the end, which... We trialed it at the Seen and Heard Festival, as you said earlier, and the ending was very well received. So hopefully we'll be able to do it again, punch it up a little bit for the longer show, and just make it work, make magic.
So the Fringe Lab then, because we've talked to a lot of guests who are doing shows for the Fringe, and it's all very exciting. What is the Fringe Lab then? Is that something, do you get some assistance in putting together a show, or what is it?
Yeah, so the Dublin Fringe Lab has a bunch of different resources. A lot of it's kind of, you know, if you need help with tech for your show, if you're looking to promote your show to, to the media, like shows like this, it's a lot of kind of networking stuff and mentorship and resources. There's also physical space that you can avail of in Temple Bar, in the Fringe building, which is great. There's two or three different kind of studio spaces that you can use there to help develop your show in physical space. And there's like mirrors, and it's fantastic. It's a really great festival. It's a really great kind of opportunity for up and coming artists to really develop their craft and develop pieces of art that they can then tour around the country, tour around the world, maybe, I don't know. An incredible way to connect with other creative people and build that community here in Dublin and, you know, wider Ireland as well.
And are you working on further shows?
Yeah, well, so I'm a gigging comedian. I'm currently running Friday nights at Hysteria Comedy, which is a comedy club that I co-founded and co-run with a bunch of other cool comedians. We're a collective. It's very, very progressive and cool. I run the Fridays, so I'm doing weekly shows. I'm emceeing shows. This is in Shin A in the city centre, just around the corner, across the river from Smock Alley, or down by bottom of Capel Street. So I'm gigging there. I'm kind of regularly performing on the comedy club scene. I've got a bit of funding for a short film that I'm working on as well. That's also kind of about the trans experience, but from a different angle again. When I'm done with this show, I'd like to write more.
Absolutely. Well, Felix, thank you so much for coming into Arena. Bad Girl will be running from the 17th to the 21st of September in the Bewley's Cafe Theatre as part of this year's Dublin Fringe Festival. For further information, go to fringefestival.com. In the late 1970s, Jargon, a folk band, was formed by musician Charlie McGettigan. They followed in the footsteps of Clannad and Pumpinghead in winning the prestigious Letterkenny Folk Festival and subsequently released three singles, Ballyburra and Me, and with Polydor in 1982, The Singer and Hey Mr. Dreamer. After taking a step back in 1983 to pursue solo projects, the band members have reunited to release a new live album, Midnight Moonlight, which was recorded at Sligo's Hawkswell Theatre. Charlie McGettigan joins me now in studio to talk about the album. It was Ballyburra and Me,
Ballyburra.
How couldn't I pronounce that?
Funny to have written a song like that, I never hadn't been to Ballyburra, in that I was working in England with a man called Patsy O'Connor, and every night on a Saturday night, over a few pints, he'd start crying into his pint and talking about this place called Ballyburra, which became a sort of a fictional place in my head. When I came back two or three or four years later, I just decided to write a song about it. And we became almost mayors of Ballybor after the
Were you with Jargon at that stage?
Yeah.
And is that the one that somebody famous was on piano?
Yes. How did you know that? we had Enya playing much longer before she became famous. And I remember Nicky Ryan was her mentor at the time. And we were out in their house out in North County, Dublin. And she was very shy, and funny, she has remained shy, really, down the years. I ended up writing a little piece for a film. I can't remember the name of the film now. But, she was just a very gentle little person, came in and played piano, didn't really make any fuss. But little did we know, she would become a world phenomenon.
Right, and was that, did she play with you more than that, or just on that track?
Just on that particular track, but she did another an album of a film music, and it was that I was asked to write in lyrics for some of the songs and stuff like that.
So can you go back to Jargon and how that was formed and how you got all your group together?
Yeah, it started in way back in 1974. Myself and Eamon Daly, who was a school teacher at the time, we entered the score competition, and after that
it's the GAA arts competition.
Yeah, and after that we decided to put a duo together, singing all those Simon and Garfunkel and James Taylor songs and people like that, and that went on. Eamon eventually left. We had people like Brendan Farrelly and Brendan Emmett, and then eventually the four piece became Brendan Emmett, Jerry Grennan, Liam Gilmartin and myself, and we just played up and down the country. I still had the day job. Everybody had a day job. Just so much fun.
Was there a big mix of music? Because tracks here is quite a mix.
Yeah, well, Ballybor and Me, is an Irish ballad, whereas one of the songs I think we're going to play tonight, the singer is a sort of an Americana, based basically on a singer called Janie Cribbs, who sang with a band called Midnight Well, and they had a lovely song called Make Yourself at Home, and she used to sing a do 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 do, and it kind of a and that sort of it's about how music can be a great sort of source of consolation to you and all kinds of things. It does so much to you.
Okay, let's listen to the singer.
Something I can really find. When I look all around, I see dark clouds are clearing into weather of another kind. And wrapped in the warmth of a singer, my mind is on another plane. Sing your ooh, sing your doo 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 doos. Singer, ease my pain. This wild world of wheeling and dealing, you've brought me through my darkest hour. In the late night time, you'll find me stealing precious moments when I'm feeling sore. And soft sounds, your reason, my confusion, make me realize I'm not insane. Sing your ooh, sing your doo doo. Singer, ease my pain.
That's the singer there from Jargon. Charlie, did you always know you had such a distinctive voice, or was it something you had to work on?
Well, I've gotten kind of used to the voice now, so it's not distinctive to me at all. No, I've always been interested in music. I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and ever since I heard the Everly Brothers and Elvis and all those sort of 50s that carried on into the 60s, and then my life changed completely when I heard the Beatles. And to this very day, I don't think a day goes by where I don't play something by the Beatles on the old Spotify machine. And I had a long story after we used to play in Bundoran 7 nights a week, 4 hours a night, which was a great training ground for us. Moved to Dublin in 1968, and the very first night I was there, I was brought to Slattery's of Cable Street, and I heard acoustic music for the first time. And this was Al O'Donnell, who was a former, worked for this station years and years ago, Frank Hart singing on stage, all in the one place, Liam O'Flynn on the pipes. I'd never really heard Ilion pipes until I heard Liam O'Flynn. Donal Lunny was there. Paul Brady was there. And these were all people. I rang my dad the next day. I need money. I need money to buy an acoustic guitar. And the rest, I sort of developed a style from watching other people playing and stuff like that. So Jargon, when it in its purest form, back with Brendan Emmett involved, was mostly acoustic. And the great thing about how we got back together, I released my memoir, a book I'd written a couple of years ago, and we Jargon got together just to sing a song or two at the
And you kept in touch, like, oh, you know, yeah, where they all were.
We remained friends. We just drifted apart, but we remained friends. And I remember looking down, and my grandson Leo was sitting in about two rows back at the launch, and his jaw was like this. He was jaw dropped, and he was saying to himself, "What's Pops doing? I never heard this kind of music before." And I said, maybe there's something in this. And since we got together again, we decided then, we'll try and get together again and do something. And we've played a lot of house parties and small venues. We even played in the library in Drumshambo, where I live. And even there were three or four little young people there, and they were mesmerised because they'd never been up close. We can do our gig with no microphones, no amplifiers. You can sit right in front of us and see how it's done. And these kids were fascinated, you know, and even younger people, young teenagers and early 20s, said they've never seen anything like this, because normally there's this whole gap with big screens and all kinds of stuff. We're just a very up close and personal group, really having fun with it.
And now recall how the song, The Singer, that we just heard,
yes,
how that was recorded. That was recorded many years ago back in Hawkswell.
In the studio. No, that was in the studio. This present album is a live album. It was actually the first ever gig we did. And the sound man, luckily enough, kept all the tracks on separate tracks. And somebody did a video. And it turned out really good. So our singer, Liam Gilmartin, he mixed it all and put it together. So it's now, we both have a live album and a live video of the whole show. And it's been just been a joy to work with the boys again, you know.
Yeah, and have all the old, you know, irritations come to light again.
All the decision making, you know, I've been so used to doing it myself, you know, just sort of saying, yeah, I can do that. Then now we have to have a meeting. But great, we can meet online now, and sort of, even to get the cover of the album. There was so much discussion going on. But eventually, I think we've got it right. And we're delighted the way it turned out.
And now, the next one we're going to hear is Yellow Roses. And this is a Ry Cooder song.
Yeah, Brian Mulligan is our newest member. Brendan Emmett, unfortunately, couldn't stay. But Brian is our double bass player. And Brian's one of these real cool jazz guys. You know, he wears the dark sunglasses. And he's going around, doo 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 da ba doo da. And he's going, and this song is a country song. So he wears a paper bag over his head when he sings this song, because he wouldn't want his jazz fans to see him singing country. So this is a Ry Cooder song.
That evokes a whole new image. Great.
I just received, sweetheart, your yellow roses. You tell me that they mean we're all through. You tell me tonight your heart is broken, but you should know I was never untrue. I'll place them near your photograph, and as the petals fall, they'll hide from you my lonely tears that should not fall at all. And then they slowly fade away and die. I still love you, though yellow roses make me cry.
That's Yellow Roses there from Charlie McGettigan and Jargon. So you're those songs, America's like the Ry Cooder song. America and American musicians are a big influence on you.
Yeah, more the acoustic end of people, you know, people like Sam Bush, Bela Fleck. I was very lucky to record with Bela Fleck when Maura Connell recorded one of my songs, Feet of a Dancer. And I was in Nashville at the time. And this girl came up beside us to sing back and vocal. She just arrived in and she sang beautiful. We did our oohs and ahs, as we call it, the agonies or the harmonies. And I didn't know who she was, never heard of her. And she said, well, I'm launching my album tonight. Why don't you come down to the cannery and see it? And it was Nancy Griffiths before she became the famous Nancy Griffiths. So that was the joy of singing in Nashville with her.
And will people who are going to your concerts around the country now hear Feet of a Dancer?
Rock and Roll Kids is in there and Feet of a Dancer is in there.
I'm sure they'd be disappointed if they didn't get the hits.
Yeah, they're jargon versions. Yeah.
And how does that sound?
Well, if you take Rock and Roll Kids, was as somebody described it as two old boogers with beards in the Eurovision, was a piano and guitar. Jargon have dobro, mandolin, double bass, guitar and three or four harmonies as well. So it'll be the same song but different.
Sounds great. Well, Jargon featuring Charlie McGettigan embark on their album tour from the 14th of September at the Backstage Theatre Longford, with more dates available on jargonmusic.com. Charlie, thank you so much.
So lovely to meet you, Kate. Thanks so very much.
Now, that's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Paula Shields and Barbara Rose Sanwu. Ruth Kennington is on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. Sean Rocks is back tomorrow night. Join us then. And thank you for listening. John Creedon is next.